You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 161 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
Hello!
You're giving me very strange looks over here.
I didn't know.
I came in too hot for you?
You didn't come in too hot. You just didn't have anything to back up what you came in with.
Who is episode 161?
See, I knew you were going to ask that, and I wanted to look it up, but I never got around to it. There's going to be like an offensive line.
That's what I was going to say.
Robbie Tobeck, maybe? Was Robbie Tobeck 61?
It's the Robbie Tobeck edition.
Because I think Chris Gray was 62. Oh, you're damn right. It's
there
the Robbie Tobeck edition.
Wow. I like the idea of him not being 61, but it's still being the Robbie Tobeck edition.
It's just,
of the Pelton Cast.
Spiritually, it's the Robbie Tobeck edition.
You know, I've really
of the Pelton Cast.
Felt like I've been channeling Robbie Tobeck a lot lately. Before we get into this, I think it's important to do a toast and to also mention some of the great Pelton Cast content that has been coming out for the last week.
Yeah, we did the trophy IPA last week, but maybe we should bring it back. In addition to, we also have the Fremont Kraken, Sky Kraken Hazy IPA.
I was at Fred Meyer and gave you numerous options for good beers that I could get. And you said, don't get beer because you have beer. And then you forgot it on the way over here. So we're drinking the trophy life again. Because you know what?
But we also have this new beer. It's just one 12-ounce can. So we also needed the trophy life to go with it. Should we read quickly about the
Sky Kraken? Have we not drank that on here?
I don't believe we have.
All right.
At the dawn of our time, near to a future sun, in the imagined universe of reality, dwells the Sky Kraken. That sounds also like a description of it being the name of the NHL Seattle team. A contradiction of the senses, offering ripe melon, juicy citrus, pineapple, and pepper flavors to the brave. An idea brought together by the cosmic attraction of opposites. Did Kyrie Irving write this?
Really
got the third eye in him. Sky Kraken is a naturally unfiltered beer. Sky Kraken is also just a really cool name for this really cool beer that we wanted to brew using the hops we love. We hope you love it too, or at least love the Sky Kraken and become a believer.
Peeking behind the curtain to just be like, fuck it, this is a cool name.
Yeah. I'm glad they acknowledged that.
I don't know how much I like that. If you haven't listened to them, you compiled not one, but two podcasts about the 1979 World Champion Sonics teams. You're really puzzled over here.
I don't know where the rest of that beer went. Did you already
This was my side beer. My main beer is the Spiked Agua Fresca.
But the Kraken is supposed to be your main beer?
You're drinking the Kraken.
Oh, I thought we were splitting it.
No. You drink the whole Kraken. You've taken my trophy life that I've already drank. Look, there's a lot of beers going on here. I was just going to drink the Spiked Agua Fresca from our good friends at Golden Road? Road Brewing Company from Los Angeles, California. For those refreshing 60-degree June Seattle days. Anyway,
summer is here, and then summer is gone again.
But two podcasts commemorating the 1979 World Champion Seattle Sonics with special guests like
Lenny Wilkins, Fred Brown, Jack Sikma, Wally Walker, and then also last Saturday, an event we'll talk about in a second, had a chance to talk to Gus Williams, Tom Lagarde, and Dennis Autry. So it's, one podcast could not contain all the material we had. Had to have two, split
you need
it into
a full
two
Lagarde
parts.
Podcast.
Split it into two parts, talking about first the rise of the Sonics from 5-17 at the start of the 1977-78 season before Lenny Wilkins came down from the front office to return as head coach and lead them that very year to the NBA Finals, only to lose in Game 7 to the Washington Bullets before getting back again the next year, avenging that loss, and then pretty quickly collapsing afterwards. Which
it doesn't matter. They still won. It's the only championship in Sonics history. One of the only championships in Seattle history for a long time.
Between 1917 and 2004, that's the only major Seattle's pro sports championship.
Wow.
So
anyway, go ahead. Stop everything that you're doing. Go ahead and listen to those podcasts. Look, they're going to age quickly.
Oh, yeah. 40 years in the making, very short shelf life. But so Saturday was, I did it because last Saturday was the 40th anniversary of the championship. So a toast to the 1979 Sonics, who were feted on Saturday. A very nice event put on by the Seattle Mariners at T-Mobile Park that I was able to attend.
The event was very nice. The baseball, not so much.
That day's baseball, not terrible.
They still lost.
They were, you know, they lost, of course, but it wasn't terrible. So, They had a pregame event and then said that afterwards there would be availability for the media. And I assumed that a lot of people would take advantage of this. There were three media members there. It was kind of wild. So we had like crazy access. I walked down to they were just hanging out in the green room where they put people who are doing the first pitch. And then as I got down
How
there
does
to find out.
How does that green room compare to the Diamond Club? Where is it at?
I mean, you walk past the Diamond Club on
the same
level.
It's like right next door.
Not right next door, but it's down the same.
How does it compare, though?
I mean, it's much smaller. There's not really that much food in there.
Okay.
It's not as good as the Diamond Club.
I'm not saying
it's as good. They weren't spending the game there. They were spending the game in a suite.
Okay. Oh, that's not bad. Okay.
Yeah.
That's where the Mariners or the Sonics players were sitting.
Yes.
Okay.
So I walk down there right as they're coming out from that room to go out to the field or be in position for the ceremony. And Art Thiel of SportsPressNorthwest.com, longtime Seattle sports fixture, who actually covered the 79 team early in his sports writing career. He and I were like in the hallway with them as they were waiting to go out to the field. Like I kept waiting for someone to come in and tell me, sir, you're not supposed to be here. And then it just never happened. So
what did the Mariners care?
So it was great. Then walked out the tunnel that leads to the field after all the players and Coach Lenny Wilkins were introduced and watched the ceremony from there, like right next to the Angels dugout.
Nice.
Yeah. Like the umpires walked by at some point during this.
And wow. Umpires up close.
Again, it's like I shouldn't be here. Someone's going to tell me I'm not supposed to be here, but they never did.
Any fan from the game could have gone down there.
Into the tunnel?
It's like, so. How many people were at the game?
It wasn't Monday night. It wasn't that attendance. Or Tuesday night. Maybe both. It was decently attended. So I watched this.
Yeah, what was the ceremony that they did?
So they had, in addition to members of I think it was seven members in the 79, or six members of the 79 team in Lenny. They also had Gary Payton was on hand and Slick Watts.
Oh, really? GP was in the house.
He was in the house.
Just... They flew him up for it?
I don't know if the Mariners flew him up. He also did a signing that day at the apparel store that has the Sonics clothing.
We've got to get GP on the freaking Pelton cast.
It is one of our great, great regrets that we have not done so. Matt Pittman was the first announcer, introduced all the players, and then Kevin Calabro took over to actually go out in the field and ask them questions.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So it's good to see KC back in Seattle representing and had some lovely highlights, a great package. And then they all simultaneously threw out the first pitch. Sadly, this my view was blocked on. I forget who blocked my view, but I couldn't see anything that was happening at the first pitch.
Okay.
And then afterwards, they walked back into this room. And like I said, there was three media members and all these players. It was kind of wild.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. So they all threw out the first pitch as in, I like to imagine that there's one catcher. Yeah. Everybody was set up with each their own catcher.
I believe so. Yes.
Okay. It wasn't like they took turns rotating.
No.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah. It was well done to the Mariners on that one.
Did they do anything else throughout the game for the 79 Sonics or just,
They kept showing the team between innings and would play some highlights and, you know, had trivia from the, you know, basically from the championship season.
Did you feel like there were fans in the game who came
before
that?
Oh, yeah. There was tons of Sonics jerseys in the crowd.
All right.
Yeah, like it wasn't quite as much. Obviously, I was revisiting in 2011. I don't know why they chose 2011, but the Mariners did a Sonics night at that point and brought back players from all eras, a pretty good collection, maybe the best collection ever of like all-time Sonics at that event.
Really?
And that was like Sonics dominated the concourse at that game. Like there was more Sonics gear than Mariners gear. I don't think it was quite to that level here.
800 Sonics fans there.
It was a Friday night. People go to Mariners games on the weekend. Well attended. There was also, as I was walking out, there was like one lone fan that was trying to get Sonic's chant started. So respect to that.
There we go. Good for him.
Yeah. But it was cool. I mean, again, it's terrible, as I wrote on Twitter, that we have to go to a Mariners game to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Sonics championship because there is no Sonics anymore. It is shameful that that is the case. But such is life.
Yep.
Anyway, the podcast is good. I feel good about that.
So go listen to those. All this is to say, go and listen to those podcasts.
I think I actually broke some news on that podcast.
Really? What news did you break?
About a locker room argument between two players during the 1980 playoffs.
Really?
Yeah. I could not find any reference to it online when I searched for it.
Where are the aggregators I know,
seriously. All we want is to be aggregated. Every other podcast is, please don't aggregate us. We're like, come on. We love you, aggregators.
We're out here breaking news that's over or 40 years old.
39 in this case, because it was the following season. But...
Come on, aggregators. What are you doing? Well, again, I feel like we should do another toast to that team.
Okay.
Because only championship in Sonic's history.
Yeah.
And will be the only championship in Sonic's history ever.
Wow. You're just calling it like that. Wow.
It is what it is.
While we're on the topic of champions.
Hello.
Let's also toast to UW Women's Crew for winning its fifth NCAA rowing championship in the 12th national title overall in program history Sunday in Indianapolis. They joined the 2017 Husky team by becoming the second ever to sweep all three grand finals at the NCAA Rowing Championships, those being the Varsity 8, the second Varsity 8, and the Varsity 4, breaking the NCAA record in all three races.
That's the women's rowing version of fo.
Yes.
It's 8-8 fo.
It is the second national title for Coach Yaz Farouk in her 3 years at UW. So huge. Congrats.
Sadly, that was not televised on ESPN over the weekend.
As I've always said, we're a women's crew school. Speaking of what was televised on ESPN over the weekend, let's pour some out for UW softball, which lost to UCLA 3-0 on a Rachel Garcia walk-off homer in the 10th inning of an elimination game on Sunday. It is the third consecutive year reaching the semifinals of the Women's College World Series for the Huskies, and a tip of the cap to the Bruins, who swept Oklahoma in the WCWS final to earn the Pac-12's first softball championship since Arizona State in 2011, which at that point was the Pac-12's sixth consecutive championship, including UW in 2009.
Let's talk about this game briefly, because I don't feel like we have to necessarily pour one out for the softball team, especially after the outcome that UCLA had in the finals, where they really destroyed Oklahoma.
I mean, the pouring one out, especially in K1.
Pouring one out that they didn't win, but this was still a great season.
Oh, of course.
They reached the Final Four.
That's a huge accomplishment, yeah.
And went toe-to-toe with UCLA.
I mean, that was a game that was balanced on a knife's edge for 10 innings. What I wanted to say is, you know, had that game gone a full 14 innings, that they should have just counted it as both of the elimination games that the Huskies would have had to win. Like, it should have counted for two wins over UCLA, because it was twice as long.
Rachel Garcia would have pitched every inning.
She sure would have.
Gone maybe 304
pitches. One of my favorite stats of the game is, like, she's got a season high 100 and something pitches.
They said that she went over 200 sometimes.
And then they flashed career high. 223.
They could have gone 100 innings.
I don't know about 100.
And still not scored a run off Rachel Garcia. I mean, it was clear in that game.
Oh, they had so many chances, though.
They had so many chances, but by the time they got, which was true through the entire Women's College World Series.
Yeah, a real tough time with runners in scoring position for the Huskies.
It was just like, she was going to shut down that offense the second a runner reached first, maybe second base.
Yeah, because they didn't basically get anyone to third base. I don't know if they ever did. I think at some point they did get a runner to third. Adam Amin kept saying that nobody had touched third base, which they touched it when they ran by. But no, the inning was already over.
The UCLA player touched third base earlier on.
No, UW. Not both teams, just UW specifically.
But they just could not get past that hump. I mean, there was like a leadoff double, and I think that runner didn't even advance to third.
I think so.
So it was like so lights out from Rachel Garcia, who then eventually hit the walk-off homer. Like Rachel Garcia, I think, was the National Player of the Year. Clearly yeah, deserved really it.
Yeah.
And it was, it's just like in softball, if you have a dominant pitcher like that, who can throw every single pitch that you're throwing, it is a very difficult thing to overcome.
So here's the good news. I'm pretty sure she's a junior. Pretty sure she's coming back.
Maybe she'll go out early.
the softball draft. Yep, she's a junior.
Oh, my God.
She redshirted. I don't understand that. How is that possible?
This is the Pac-12.
Oh, she had a knee injury. That's okay. Why she redshirted.
I was going to say, Pac-12 like softball, you can have superstar players redshirt.
I mean, we'll get to UW in a second, but an interesting fact about the UW pitching staff.
It was very fun to watch UW throughout this weekend and seeing a couple of the games that they played. Where, I mean,
it was not fun at all.
The games on Saturday were fun, and the game on Sunday was fun also.
No, it was horrible because softball is so tense all the time. It's like people talk about playoff baseball. I've never seen that before.
I remember playoff baseball.
Or people talk about hockey. Like it's the same thing as these where soccer is like this as well. Like one mistake can change the entire game because of the fact that these games are often so low scoring. So you're just like nervous literally the entire game.
It's terrible. Fun. It's fun.
I mean, I love it, but it's terrible.
It was fun watching. I mean, that game that Taryn Alvelo pitched on Saturday night just lights out.
Yeah.
After coming in to get the save earlier and then dominating in game two, it was an impressive day.
I was walking to I was going to call it Safeco Field, to T-Mobile Park after parking during the last inning, the seventh inning, where Gabby Plane kind of melted down a little bit and Alvelo had to come in relief. And I lost reception at some point on my streaming and then went into the stadium and got it back just in time to see Alvelo record the final out, having not known that she was even in the game. And I was like, okay, had it all the way.
It is kind of funny in softball because we're so accustomed to baseball rules. Seeing a pitcher start the game, pitch whatever seven innings or whatever Gabby Plane pitched, then have Taryn Alvelo come in relief, then have Gabby Plane come in again.
I mean, that wasn't in that game.
This was on Sunday. Yeah. I'm just saying it's like such a wild thing to watch.
It is, yes.
A pitcher leaving the game and then coming back in.
Don't let anyone tell baseball about that. Like, they would totally do it. Like baseball managers would be so excited if they could use relievers multiple times.
Maybe relievers. Baseball players for one inning and then have to ice their arm after that.
Well, that is a key difference. But it would be like when the Mariners stashed Jeff Nelson in left field for a batter back in 1993.
Wait, really?
Oh yeah. Lupinella wanted to bring in a lefty, but he wanted to keep Nelson in the game afterwards.
You should actually probably do that more.
I mean, you'd be trying so hard to hit it to left field that I feel like it would actually be counterproductive.
Especially if you're... So you'd have a lefty facing them, so you'd have to go opposite field, right?
I mean, the downside, of course, is that you lose your left fielder. Whoever it was at
Brian
that point...
Brian Turing's gone?
Wasn't a big deal. Tiny Felder, probably.
I guess that is true. But if you're in a tight game, this is something that, again, you just pinch hit for him, right? You lose your left fielder for one play, but then when the other pitcher goes out, then you have a new left fielder.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the loss of the player off the bench, especially now that baseball teams keep so few field players in reserve.
Do they?
Yeah.
Oh.
Because they have so many pitchers.
Oh.
They're expanding the rosters next year.
Wait, really?
Yeah, you didn't know about this?
From 25-man rosters?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's happening next
25
year.
Men is not enough for baseball?
No, because there's like it's like 15 pitchers and 10 hitters now.
This is a new trend?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we're going to get the trend started of stashing players in the outfield. Instead of
restarted. Restarted.
Restarted. Lupinella started the trend.
Galaxy brand.
Anyway, UW softball. It was a fun weekend. Love watching UW softball. It was fun going to the game. We'll sort of assess later kind of where the team stands going into next year. But before then...
It's time to resume our search for Seattle's best sandwich, which we are not stashing in. Well, I guess we stashed in left field the week that we talked about hot dogs. But this week, we went
to... Fuck you, we're talking about hot dogs.
The Swinery in West Seattle. I think the first location that has been in multiple searches for Seattle's best food, I believe. Because
are you joking? Marination was last week.
Oh, never. All right. Good point. Good point. Okay, the second.
I'm pretty sure there are others. I think we went to Skillet multiple times.
No, I don't think we've been back to Skillet in a search capacity. So the Swinery, we went there for the burger, which is kind of maybe their most famous thing.
You think so?
They have a ton. They only have a burger, and they have a bunch of sandwiches on the menu. But I do think the burger gets like the most publicity.
Okay.
So, the Swinery opened in 2009 as a development of Chef Gabriel Kleikamp's homemade bacon production. Kleikamp left the next year, but Swinery stayed open and is now employee owned by head chef Kimian Lavelle and butcher sous chef Danny Rogers, and they also sell meats in addition to cooking up sandwiches and burgers.
Their meats look pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I had some of the, they shaved off like a sample of some of their brisket that they have. It's like deli meat brisket. It's really interesting.
And it's like, and their whole thing is local, working with local suppliers, high quality meats, and they're grilling them up right there on the back patio there.
I feel like the whole situation is pretty incredible. Yeah. Like walking into a butcher, it's always impressive. I love looking at meats. I feel like their meats might be some of the most impressive to look at.
It's probably cut above Hitchcock Deli when that was operational in Georgetown.
I don't really remember looking at theirs, but I remember like Rain Shadow or whatever. They have a lot of sausages and stuff, and you're like, this is good, but I think Swinery is, it's really something. And they have some more exotic type cuts. And then also just like everything they have is like, oh my God, look at this.
Yeah.
But the sandwiches, so they had quite a few options. Let's say, do they have today the Philly cheesesteak?
I think that's permanently on there as a daily special.
Okay. So they had, let's say, five or six options for sandwiches. Philly cheesesteak, which is a daily special. I felt like we had to do, what do they call it? The Swinery?
The Spectacular.
The Swinery Spectacular. Because it has the name in it. You want to get the signature sandwich while you're somewhere. And can you tell me what's in the sandwich?
That's an official Peltoncast rule, I think.
That should be an official rule of life.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying we're the ones establishing it's a rule of life.
We invented the idea.
Pulled pork, ham, crispy pork belly, Swiss cheese, Dijon, and pickles.
It is a beast of a sandwich.
The one thing that surprised me, so they serve all their sandwiches on Macrina buns, which are outstanding.
Including the burger also.
That is correct. And so one thing I didn't anticipate is that the exact same bun as the burger. So it's basically like a burger or chicken sandwich size. But it's just much higher piled with meats.
Oh my God, there are a lot of meats. Was the Dijon like dripping off of yours? Oh my God. It's like a thick, rich, creamy Dijon.
It's interesting. Like I wasn't sure until I went back and looked at it that there was actually cheese on there because the Dijon, I feel like, kind of dominated the cheese.
It overpowers the cheese.
Flavor-wise. Yeah. Which was fine. And the cheese also provided like a nice texture to things.
So I think Danny Chow famously described Nashville hot chicken as a 24-hour experience. The Swinery Spectacular is at least an 18-hour experience.
I mean, I'm only at like, what am I now? Like 10 hours?
Wait till tonight.
Oh boy.
It comes back. I ate this sandwich at like 4 o'clock. It was around 4 o'clock. And I was like, it was a lot to eat because it's a lot of meats and it really hits your stomach. So you're full. By like 8:30 or 9, my stomach hurts so bad. It was as if I'd just eaten a meal at like 8:30 or 9. I was so full. And then even by the next morning, I was so full. I woke up and I was just like, oh my God.
I ate it for lunch at around 1 and did not eat a real meal the rest of the day.
You had to get a McFlurry, right? What was your description of why?
I needed something that was soft.
That was going to calm your stomach?
I mean, my stomach doesn't necessarily need to be calm, but I felt I needed to eat something, but I definitely couldn't eat like solid, substantial food.
It is. This is an incredible sandwich. I mean, just also so rich, so much flavor, yes, and stacked full of meats. And you know what? I would do it again.
It was worth it. So can I give you my one negative here?
Okay.
I feel like the crispy pork belly, kind of dry.
The pork? You thought the pork belly was dry?
I did. I mean, I thought that, especially by comparison to the pulled pork, which was very juicy and flavorful.
Uh-huh.
I just enjoyed that so much more than the bites of crispy pork belly, which suggests that maybe I should try something else in the future. They also have a barbecue pulled pork sandwich or a Cubano that includes the pulled pork, smoked pork sirloin.
There we go.
Swiss cheese and Cuban
it's
aioli.
It's like at the winery, they have to sneak something else in. You can't just have the pulled pork.
Well, the barbecue is pretty much just pulled pork.
Oh my God.
I believe they have some homemade onions in there, but...
I mean, I guess if I had to give a negative, it's like I would like a mixture of flavors instead of just all rich, right? They're pummeling you with the rich. It's like I could have used something red in this. You know, there was no sense of like spicy or anything like that, right? It was just over the top rich flavors.
Maybe you should try the barbecue as well.
Yeah, I'm down to try anything. Their food is excellent.
It is.
It's just like every single piece of the sandwich is so good, even down to the Dijon.
Yeah, the Dijon was great.
Where you're like, hey, where did this Dijon come from? It's the best I've ever had.
It's like a creamy Dijon, so it's not a very like tangy necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's not a sharp note.
On top of a pork belly is a creamy Dijon.
Well, I thought it gave it a little moisture, so it was nice.
No, it definitely needed a sauce because it was a lot of meat.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, I felt like I had to do this time. I don't know if I would necessarily get the same sandwich again, but it gives me confidence that every other sandwich is great.
I mean, look, just give me that pulled pork and the Macarena bun and I'm good.
The Macarena bun is so good.
Yeah.
And they like prepare it perfect. Like, granted, Macarena buns are going to be good no matter what, but it's like the right amount of warm and like soft and like a little bit gooey. And then you have the meat on it and the sauce. It's just, it's a great package.
Where does it rate?
It's really tough to judge this. I mean, these are all so tough because this is an elite level sandwich, right?
Yep.
I think it is a 95. Ooh. 90. I'm going to give it a 94.
Okay. I went with 93.
I love that it was like a hot take for me to be a 95.
A 95 is pretty high. I mean, that would be...
This is up there with the sandwiches that we've had.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't mean to say that, like a honey hole sandwich can't compete with this. Right? Like, a lot of the sandwiches that we've had really cannot compete with this as far as... I mean, honestly, even the other coast. Like, the other coast...
You lost me there.
The other coast is more Subway than it is Swinery.
Oh, what?
We are talking about such high quality meats that are going into this.
I think their meats are equally high quality.
The preparation, this is real preparation here that goes into the sandwich.
We're talking difference is they're just
pork
more
belly
thin sliced on the.
I don't know. That's
a very troubling take.
Most of the other sandwich places that we're going to
really losing some credibility with this take
are not coming anywhere close to the quality of meat.
There's
that you're
a respect for the meat at the Swinery.
It's the Swinery.
It sure is.
There's a respect for the meat. And it's like there's one thing where it's like you always want to have respect for the meat, right?
Of course.
But they understand the packaging of the meat also by having it on that perfect Macarena bun, by having the Dijon, right? So it's more like I really like this sandwich. I don't think that this sandwich was Seattle's best sandwich, but I wouldn't be shocked if I went back and one of the other ones was.
Mm, yeah, that's a reasonable take. I like where you're going with that one.
And if I have a situation where I only need to eat one meal in a day, this is the one meal that I want to eat.
I mean, believe me, there's a lot of these places you could go to, and that would be your only meal for the day, depending on what you ordered.
If you
get the 12-inch Raging Cajun.
That's too much Raging Cajun. But that's what I'm saying. Okay, so the Raging... When I said, I want a red thing on this, like that Raging Cajun sauce, where it's like, it's rich, but it's spicy.
Yes.
You know, and I think that this would have done... I think this would have been helped by something like that, with a little bit of like a tangy type of flavor. And I don't know.
Kind of like a barbecue?
Barbecue is a different thing, though. Barbecue's a lot to handle also. Look, let's go back for barbecue. Fourth of July. I'm telling you, Fourth of July, we've got to have swinery right around there.
It's interesting because the previous time I had been there, we went twice because it made the tournament in our search for Seattle's best sandwich or burger.
I don't know if I went back a second time.
You must have. It was too far apart. But I went on July 2nd. It was right before the 4th of July.
I went on the 4th of July. I was dressed as Bruce Springsteen on the Born in the USA album cover.
It wasn't Halloween. It was the 4th of July.
No, that's what I do every 4th of July.
I get it.
Your hat never fits in your back pocket. Just not a natural place to put a hat.
Very odd place to put a hat.
Anyway, it was great. Like, I want to eat it again.
I don't know if I'll be in Seattle on the 4th of July, but we'll see on that, your plan.
Something about, I think maybe it's because we went there for the burger on the 4th of July last time, where to me, I'm like, these are 4th of July sandwiches.
Well, also, you can get meats there to grill up on the 4th of July.
Oh, man, the meats. Anyway, I really fuck with the swinery.
Yeah.
I guess is what I'm trying to say. I don't know if this was Seattle's best sandwich, but I really fuck with the swinery.
Should we get back to sports?
All right.
The Seattle Sounders, a tough week for them, losing 2-1 on Saturday at FC Dallas in a game delayed by thunderstorms in the area, much like the Husky softball game earlier that day. And then earlier Wednesday, before we record this, suffering a 2-1 loss at Montreal Impact, their third consecutive loss, dropping them to 7-4-5 heading into this 3-week-long international break from MLS play. At Dallas, the Sounders conceded a pair of own goals in the first half before pulling one back through Raul Ruidíaz in the 65th minute. That was the only one they were going to get. Expected goals, according to 538, saw that game as much more defensive struggle than the actual scoreline indicated. Sounders kind of unlucky to give up two goals, but also lucky to have scored at all in that one based on the chances they created. On Wednesday, the Sounders without 8 players who had been called up to join their national team. So, I mean, Montreal was also significantly shorthanded. They had some call-ups, and then also their star player was out injured.
Who's their star player?
Ignacio Piatti?
Oh, yeah, him. Yeah. I know about him.
Okay. This one, in terms of shot-based
goals.
He's
on the Canadian national team.
Oh. You played against them in FIFA?
I had him on Impact Montreal.
Oh, right. Yeah, you were saying you played with Montreal. In this game, Montreal, a pretty substantial impact in terms of shot-based expected goals.
Pun intended? Montreal, a pretty substantial impact?
No, that was not intended. That was misspeaking. That was a malaprop. The Sounders scored on both teams had penalties in the second half of this match. The Sounders got a nice finish from Victor Rodriguez to their penalty with Nicola Ladero unavailable and Raul Ruidíaz. And then the Impact answered with a penalty of their own and then scored a second goal within a 5-minute span to get this victory. The Sounders saw 16-year-old midfielder Danny Leiva make his debut in the second half of this match as a substitute, becoming the youngest player in Sounders history.
16. Okay.
He celebrated a birthday since he was signed at age 15. So the Sounders will have, like I said, 3.5 weeks off from MLS play. They will be in action next week. The Sounders will host Portland in the U.S. Open Cup at Cheney Stadium next Wednesday in their first U.S. Open Cup match of the year.
Which hopefully we'll see them sort of get back into form in the U.S. Open Cup, where they started out the franchise kind of dominating that competition.
Yep.
And haven't necessarily recently, including some losses, notably against Portland.
Yes. Now, the one match you're thinking of against Portland that you went to with the Clint Dempsey tearing up the referee scorebook and Obafemi Martin suffering a hamstring injury.
Maybe the greatest soccer match I've ever been to.
I don't know if I would call that greatest.
It was easily the most notable soccer match I've ever been most to. Memorable. Plus, we were in freaking Tequila.
So
they play, when they're doing these matches, they're now playing in Tacoma.
Yeah, they followed what was S2, now the Tacoma Defiance FC, down to Tacoma, apparently.
Interesting. That's kind of disappointing.
Yeah, it is a bummer. I guess it's a better venue for it, though, probably in terms of crowd size, because the Starfire facility was just so tiny for these first team matches.
And they have a bigger field down there in Tacoma?
I mean, they're playing at Cheney Stadium.
Oh, they play soccer at Cheney? I guess you said that. They play soccer at Cheney Stadium. Until that's where the Defiance play?
Yeah, until they build in the rain, until they build this soccer-specific stadium.
I feel like you probably said this on podcast like 30 times.
Oh, yeah. That's the it's the part of the podcast you don't listen to. Wait.
But did you review the tapes about whether you told me that I could be on Blazers Outsiders?
I have not reviewed the tapes on that yet.
Ooh. That didn't happen, and I'm going to be on Blazers Outsiders.
We'll look forward to that next year. So, I mean, this will be a case where obviously the Sounders will be without most of their best players for this game, but usually in the early stages of the Open Cup, you wouldn't be playing those players.
Is this a must-win game, though?
Yeah, it's one and done, the Open Cup.
These always make me nervous. It's like...
They should. But so I was going to say...
Why do teams not care about these matches? Because winning the Open Cup matters.
I mean, basically, it's like if you get far enough, you start caring about it. But at the early stage, it's not worth the disruption to your MLS season. Because that also matters, is it? And matters more. I mean, you wouldn't trade... Would you trade the four U.S. Open Cups for the one MLS Cup? Like, they didn't throw a parade for any of the U.S. Open Cups. They did for the MLS Open Cup.
But did they for the Supporter Shield?
No.
That's the real comparison.
But the Supporter Shield is what puts you in position, especially now that home field means a lot more in the playoffs. And the Sounders, by the way, down to third in the West with 26 points.
I'm not going to see any sort of Supporter Shield this year.
No. LAFC has that all but locked up already.
I'm just saying, the way that you get to the position to caring about the matches, you're just like, well, if we have our secondary players or whatever, developmental players, and they happen to win, then we'll care.
Yeah.
But it's like, why don't you care to begin with?
So, I mean, the other thing that's happened that I was going to say before we got sidetracked by talking about Clint Dempsey tearing up scorecards is that the Sounders in the early days, it was a bid for who hosted the games. And so they played all of those games until maybe like the semifinal at Starfire, which is also this tiny little facility. Like, they had a huge home field advantage in those matches. And then at some point, the U.S. Open Cup switched to where it's a coin flip for who hosts the matches now.
Really?
Yeah.
So
they've played a lot of the times when they've lost early in the U.S. Open Cup, they've been playing on the road.
50% of the time on the road. 50% of the time at home.
I mean, I don't know what the exact is.
Is somebody actually flipping a coin there? Or yeah. Do they have a program?
Well, one year when they were doing, I don't know if it was for the final or what, but the coin flip was conducted by Sunil Gulati, at the time the president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, at the Men in Blazers live show that I attended in Portland at the MLS All-Star Game.
They did the coin flip live?
He came out on stage and flipped a coin. It was
there
great.
There we go. Yeah. That's what I like to see.
Yeah. So it's good news for the Sounders to be hosting this one against Portland, is what I'm saying here.
Great. They're still playing in Tacoma, like...
Well, from like a attending standpoint or from a chances of victory standpoint?
A chances of victory standpoint.
I think that there's going to be a very pro-Sounders crowd in Tacoma. Fun fact.
They're slightly closer to Portland.
I mean, it is true. They are slightly closer to Portland. I don't think that's going to be a big factor. You know what they're a lot closer to than Portland?
What?
Seattle.
Do you think...
I mean, we're going to talk about this in a second, but the Storm, huge home court advantage in Everett so far.
Do you... Until they play Vancouver. do you think that if you're playing sort of like developmental players, home field advantage matters more than if you're playing your starters?
No, I think it probably matters about the same amount.
I disagree.
You think it matters more?
Well, I'm assuming that most teams have relatively similar sort of like a developmental system, right? Like this is not Barcelona's developmental system.
I mean, they're not going to be playing all 16-year-olds out there. I mean, you know, there's going to be regulars because the difference is in past years, there's not this extended international break that the MLS is, I'm sorry, MLS, not the MLS, that MLS is taking this year because of the CONCACAF Gold Cup, the Copa America down in South America, and then I guess in Europe they're just working on qualifying at this point for the Euro in 2020. But because of that, there's no MLS game on the schedule. They're off until June 29th. So
why don't they play all the starters in this game?
Well, because all the starters are off playing for their national
team. Every starter is gone.
But I think that most
anybody
of the starters...
Anybody who's left should play.
I mean, we'll see if they rest Stephen Fry. That's another thing. Teams often use the Open Cup to play their second keeper and give them a little bit of experience, mix up that position a little bit.
I don't know why I'm so angry about this. It just doesn't make sense to me logically.
I mean, if you want to maximize your chances of winning a trophy, you should care a lot about the U.S. Open Cup. That's the answer. And if you want to maximize your chances, because I believe it's still the case that the U.S. Open Cup winner qualifies for the CONCACAF Champions League, which has definitely been an important goal for the Sounders.
It means that you get to play important matches on sort of like an international level against real competition.
Yeah. But you're also not guaranteed of winning it just because you get to the semifinal.
I understand that you're not, but why don't you try? There's no logic to this. I've always felt this way.
Okay.
Like, what is the difference?
Winning, pass that along to Schmetz.
Winning this tournament would be more important than winning one regular season match or whatever. Like, what are your chances of victory in any given regular season match decrease by playing your starters in the U.S. Open Cup? It can't be that much.
I mean, it depends the extent to which you have to rest those players then in the MLS game on the weekend if you're playing a U.S. Open Cup game midweek.
Or maybe you just, like, mix up the rosters where you do sort of a hybrid for each of those games, right. Give yourself a pretty good chance of winning each of those matches. Like, why is this that hard? And then you can win a trophy.
I mean, especially the last few years when the Sounders have been playing these.
Do I have you on board with this?
I mean,
winning a trophy is more important than just getting to the playoffs or whatever and losing in an early round.
I mean, yes, but if you just make the MLS Cup playoffs, historically you have had a decent chance of making a run because it's so unpredictable once you get there.
Okay, let's say that you could have the five, how many, six teams go from each conference?
Yes. Seven? Yeah. I think it's seven now. Only the number one seed gets a bye.
Okay, what if it was the 3-4 seed or 4-5 seed or whatever?
So it's one seed difference?
I mean, it can't be that much more than that. And you win the U.S. Open Cup.
I mean, obviously in that case, I would take the win the U.S. Open Cup. But you're not guaranteed the winning the U.S. Open Cup is part of what I'm trying to tell you here.
If you are basically punting on these matches, just being like, if we win, we win, that's great. But we don't really care. Your chances of winning become much lower.
Yes.
I don't understand the strategy. Fundamentally, I do not understand the strategy. And maybe this is something that people who understand soccer better than I do get, but to me, it just feels like negligence.
Negligence? Wow, that's harsh. So speaking of Tacoma and Cheney Stadium, a disappointing 1-1 home draw for Reign FC with Houston Dash on Sunday. The Reign led from the 32nd minute.
You should have asked me to guess what their nickname was.
Oh, you're right. I should have.
Because that's what I feel like we do some teams a lot. The Thorns. We've heard about the Thorns a lot.
You know the Thorns.
The Houston Dash, though, that's a brand new one.
I'm sure I mentioned it at some point on the podcast. Before the Dash got the equalizing goal in the 90th minute. Reign FC will be off this weekend with the start of the Women's World Cup on Friday. Megan Rapinoe and the US WNT will open their play in the World Cup in France on Tuesday against Thailand. 538's projections make France a slight favorite over the US to win the World Cup because they are playing host.
So the U.S. neutral site would be the favorites?
Yes.
France as host, favorites though.
The other really interesting thing is if both those teams win their groups, they would play each other in the quarterfinals.
Oh,
not even
God.
In the semifinals.
Wow.
So there's actually pretty significant, strategic, I'm not sure what the word is I'm looking for here, but reason for those two teams, one of those two teams to tank their group and finish second in the group so you can get on the other side of the bracket from the other one.
Do you think that'll happen?
Almost certainly not.
Speaking of soccer strategy that maybe I don't understand here. No, I cannot see France doing that, hosting the cup.
And U.S., like, it's just never the U.S. mentality to do that kind of thing. Like, you see it often with other countries in international competition. Australia basketball a few years ago, I can't remember if that was at the World Cup or at the Olympics, but they pretty clearly threw a game because it was better for them strategically.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess at the same time, we'll continue talking about...
Spain might also have done it at one point, and I think that's what led Nicolas Batum to punch who was it? Oh, I forget which Spanish player it was. Punched him in the groin.
He punched somebody in the groin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, at the end
of the game. Let me see who we've got here. We've got Rudy Fernandez.
I don't think it was Rudy.
Two Gasols, Rubio.
Rudy's his teammate. I don't think he would have done that to Rudy.
What other Spanish players are there?
I can't really remember who it was. Juan Carlos Navarro.
Oh, La Bamba. There we go.
La Bamba. Did not expect that one's going to come up here today, but there you go.
I'm looking forward to the World Cup, though.
Me too.
That starts on Friday?
It does.
All right.
Yep.
Sign me up.
Yeah. U.S. looking to defend the winning the World Cup last time out in Vancouver, which is close to Everett. We're the Seattle Storm.
There we go.
Got an 84-77 win
transition
on Tuesday against the Minnesota Lynx.
That's a professional transition.
It sure was. Capping a 2-2 week for them in this busy week that included three games on the road. They lost to those same Lynx 72-61 last Wednesday in Minnesota to start the trip. Got a comfortable 82-66 win on Friday at Atlanta, and then lost a narrow 83-79 finish on Saturday at Chicago in their only back-to-back of the season.
In a game that they kind of fought back in, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was an impressive performance, I think.
How is Chicago?
Probably not very good, but it's early to know.
Okay, so given everything that we know about the Storm so far this year.
Storm are good.
Wow.
Yeah.
You beat me to the question. They're just good.
I knew what question was coming. I do some readings that adjust your point differential for the schedule you've faced, and strictly based
on the same thing too.
Results this season. Yeah. You've got a spreadsheet? Strictly based on results this season, which is not always the best measure this early in the season before things have started to stabilize, but I like having that as a measure. And the Storm so far come out as the third best team in the league behind Minnesota, which was the last unbeaten team before losing to the Storm.
There we go.
They started 3-0, and Connecticut are the two teams ahead of the Storm thus far.
All right.
So this is like pretty incredible, all things considered. They've been a league average offense, the fourth best defense out of 12 in the league thus far. They're going to win with defense, but they've gotten pretty strong play at the point from Jordan Canada. Natasha Howard's been great. She was the WNBA Player of the Week last week.
Really? Yeah. So Natasha Howard's really stepped up here.
Yeah, she's the one really filling the void created by the absence of Breanna Stewart and Sue Bird. Alicia Clark missed three of the first four games to rest because of the fact that she got back so late from playing a five-game finals in France that wrapped up 2 days before the start of the season. The first game she played was at Atlanta. She was like, I don't know, a huge plus in terms of plus minus in that game coming off the bench.
Well, and also like pretty like, I mean, I suppose this is true for all players who are coming back from Europe, but just like game ready.
Yes.
Right? There's no rust there.
No, certainly no rust.
Just in the finals.
And then on Tuesday against Minnesota back home was her first start of the season, and again had a great game, 16 points, solidly positive in terms of plus minus. And so having her back is a big positive. The Storm were not only without Bird and Stewart for three of those first four games, but also a third starter from the championship team in Alicia Clark.
How was Everett for the second time? How was Everett on a weekday?
It took a long time to get to. It was a long drive. The crowd was solid. I would say not spectacular, but looked good and was into the game, and definitely a plus for the Storm against Minnesota, a tough team that, you know, started well. And kind of a disappointing outcome, I think, for the Lynx.
How long did it take you to drive there?
An hour and 15 minutes.
That's not too bad. I feel like Everett's an hour no matter what.
Pretty much, yeah.
Literally no matter where you leave from, Everett's an hour.
I mean, it was only 40 minutes for me on a Saturday.
Really?
For the opening game. Or maybe it was 45.
There's no way that's true.
It wasn't.
My house should be closer.
No, your house is not closer.
Even if I'm taking 405 north?
I mean, maybe, but I don't know.
The one time I drove to Everett for that Silver Tips game.
Long.
It was brutal. Somehow it's always pouring rain whenever you drive to Everett.
It was not pouring rain on Tuesday. It was quite pleasant.
That's good.
The Storm with one game left in Everett before making the move to Heckhead. They'll play a couple more later in the season in Everett for a total of five up there. And then I think...
How did they choose which games to play there?
Just based on the availability of Heckhead.
Oh, interesting.
So while the school year is going on, I think it's not available to the Storm.
Mm-hmm. They've got intramural basketball going on.
They sure do. I think that's at the IMA. The Storm start a 4-game, 8-day road trip because of that venue availability on Sunday.
When do they play home games?
A lot during the middle of the season.
Okay.
They'll start Sunday by again paying a second visit of the year to Chicago and then Tuesday at Indiana, which has started surprisingly well thus far. A roster move for the Storm earlier Wednesday. They waived second round pick Anriel Howard, who had made the roster, is the 12th and final player, and in her place signed backup point guard Blake Dietrich, who played 2 games for the Storm as a rookie in 2016, played last year in Atlanta. The Storm hadn't had another healthy point guard on the roster after Seabird's knee surgery. Jordan Canada, they'd been back here up with Shavonte Zelis, who's not really a natural point guard. And then Zelis missed Tuesday's game due to a left knee injury. And so that left Sammy Whitcomb running the point, which is not really her forte.
Not a ball handler.
I mean, she is, but it's just like very different to be a point guard running the offense, getting everyone in position, that sort of thing. So the Storm have struggled with Jordan Canada on the bench this season. Good to get another, a more proven point guard, I think, in that spot. Not a surprise to me that that happened.
All right.
Seahawks holding their offseason. Are they still OTAs?
OTAs?
Yeah. To me, the big takeaway is that Shoddy met the media.
Oh, God.
I think for the
Shoddy meets the media.
Yeah. I think for the first time this offseason, I feel like that he's done a press conference. And this was the quote that obviously stood out to me and perhaps the listener. We make no apologies for how we play. We want to run the football. We want to be physical. We want to take our shots. So they're looking at last year and just mission accomplished.
Oh.
No need to change anything.
Mission accomplished. There's really nothing to say. Like, we just...
It is what it is.
It is what it is. We know what this team is. We know that this team is going to be frustrating. It's so rare for a sports team that you follow, especially in a sport like football, where I feel like their philosophies are almost as important as talent, right? Do you agree with that?
I don't know if I would say as important.
Philosophies are important in football, I guess, let's just say.
Coaching is important in football, and it's informed by your philosophy.
It is so rare that the philosophy of the team that you cheer for will line up with your own personal philosophy, and sometimes you're left with Shoddy.
I don't know if I'd say it's rare.
The thing that I just don't grasp is this sort of, like, we've beaten this to death. The, like, number that they have of runs that adds up or whatever.
Well, Third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin did a nice piece on The Athletic Seattle last week about how there's definitely, like, if you actually look at the data, there's nothing magical about 53 versus 52 versus 54. Like, the more runs and pass completions you get, the better.
Oh, but it's also runs plus pass completions needs to equal 53.
Yes.
Or greater.
Yes.
Or which, exactly 53.
It's 53 or greater. You're not going to stop at 53. Like, all of a sudden start throwing incomplete passes. That'd be great. He pointed out, it was something that I had not remembered, that under Tom Cable, the number was 50.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The number got higher? The number just changed. Oh, my God.
But also some excellent research pointing out that there is a correlation between the number of runs plus pass completions you have in your chances of winning, but it's strictly driven, as many of these stats are, by the fact that teams run out the clock when they're leading in the fourth quarter.
We all understand this. That's the thing. It's like, why do we understand this?
We understand this. We as in the world doesn't all understand this.
But I'm just saying it's so obvious in our minds, right? Like, if you explain it to me, I'd be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That's it. Why is it that this isn't obvious to people who are offensive fucking coordinators in the NFL? Like, what is the disconnect there? I don't believe... Here's the thing, is I don't think that Shoddy or whatever... Pete Carroll, maybe. I don't think that Shoddy thinks this is a magic number. I think that he understands...
Shoddy's the one who brought in 53... and changed it from 50.
He's like, we're getting that up, baby. I think that Shoddy understands what the mandate is.
I mean, yes.
He knows what the deal is. He wants to keep his job.
But Shadi also was hired for a specific reason. It's because of the fact that his offenses have always run like this.
There's still a little bit of... I mean, we talked about the first 2 weeks of last year where the team passed too much. Pete Carroll got angry. But
I still don't know. Quite
have you seen happened. This thing about the Bears where they did the... Oh, my God. How did they describe it? About the Masters quiet for their kickers? The Bears are so consumed by kicking that they're going to go 4-12 this year.
All their practice time is devoted to
it. I want the Bears to be bad. I like the Bears as a team, but I want them to be bad so badly because of how consumed they are by something that is just meaningless noise.
How long was the kick? 47 yards? The Cody Parkey kick? But they were like having kickers practice from that exact distance.
No, they're having kickers practice where everybody's quiet because that's more tense. It's just like
I think that actually does make sense.
Even if it makes sense, you're talking about a kicker. Like, you should be thinking about so many different things right now aside from kicking.
It's literally all the whole practice is
the Bears have spent their entire offseason thinking about something that is mostly random, which granted a lot of teams do, but it's just like they'll probably be 7-9 next year and then be like, wow, we sure wasted an entire season by being consumed by kicking. We should have just brought Cody Parkey back.
I mean, the important thing is that they signed him to a large contract the previous offseason. The Bears
Jim Mora being mad 43 yards. They're like if Jim Mora being mad at Olindo Mari after that one loss was an entire franchise and an entire offseason. That was my favorite story. But the thing is, like, people are reporting this as if it's, like, a good thing that they're doing. And instead of being like, hey, it's kind of weird that the Bears are focusing on their OTAs, on their fucking kicker, and how quiet it is. It's like, we should maybe be thinking a little bit more about Trubisky here than your kicker.
Probably, yes.
Anyway,
so
it's just like
Shoddy.
But which is why. I guess
I'm trying to answer this, but you
have an answer.
5 minutes talking. I do. I mean,
you really have an answer, but the Bears thing is pretty funny.
I mean, it's funny. I'm glad we talked about it. I think that if you're a head coach or an offensive coordinator or anywhere in a coaching staff, the experiences of a single game are visceral. Like, it's one thing to talk about, you know, kind of from a detached standpoint, like, this is what the numbers say, or the long-term trend. But instead, you remember those two games at the start of the season where the Seahawks didn't run very often and they lost both those games. And that, like, hits Pete Carroll right in his heart. And he's not thinking about, again, the trend over thousands of games all time. He's thinking about what's happened that I remember in games that is very, you know, very tangible to me.
Okay, so I understand that and I agree with you. However, why then does the playoff game not hit harder?
Oh, because there was a lack of execution.
Because
that's a great question.
If you're saying that it's personal experience, and I do think that the Seahawks have been reactionary in many ways, but for some reason they haven't been reactionary about losing that playoff game against the Cowboys and running too much.
Nope. Mission accomplished.
Whatever. It's the OTAs. Who cares? Just the overreaction on the OTAs is the one thing. Like, you complain about people caring too much about the preseason.
Yeah.
Imagine if the preseason was just practice.
I mean, I care about the things that coaches say that seem to translate into actions.
It just doesn't. This is what we thought it was.
No, it's, I mean, yes, it's not like there's any surprise. It's just,
no breaking news here.
It's just, it's been a long time since we've heard this.
We haven't heard from Shoddy in a while.
Yeah.
We know what's going to happen. But that's the thing is, like, I don't get how they could have reached such a high level professionally and not understand causation and correlation.
Well, if that's not the differentiator between, you know, the people you're hiring, then that can be how it happens.
Or your head coach is 76 years old.
No, but still looks great.
Oh, love Pete. Only we can talk bad about Pete. Nobody else can.
We mean Seahawks fans?
Yeah, yeah. No, if an opponent said anything bad about Pete.
Oh, never.
Yeah, we'd defend him to death.
Done here? There's a transition.
We done here?
All right, let's talk about Husky softball in 2020.
Before then, did you hear Bill Simmons on his podcast with Chuck Klosterman talking about Matisse Thybulle?
Oh, yes. We didn't talk about that. Yeah, he was selling him as a draft pick.
Despite not being able to pronounce Matisse Thybulle.
No, he did. He pronounced it shockingly accurately.
It's not that hard. I would say that Matisse Thybulle's name is pronounced phonetically.
Well, neither is Robert Horry's name.
There's probably a lot of people you could come up with there.
I mean, I think the one question that I have, so basically the argument he laid out is, look, we know Matisse Thybulle is this awesome defender. If he can shoot even a little bit, he's going to be a really valuable player. Why isn't he going in the top 20 picks? Is basically his argument.
I think he said, why isn't he a top? Oh, he did say top 20.
Yeah.
Which, so it's weird. They had the written mock had him, I think, at 21 from the Ringer.
That is correct.
Which was to the
Oklahoma City Thunder.
But on their mock that they did
In video,
he went earlier. And I think Matisse is destined to go earlier than 21.
We'll see. I mean, I think the one question I have with that particular line of thinking is, I don't think, based on the transition from college to pro and the fact that he was so dominant the last 2 years in his zone, that you can necessarily pencil in, hey, Matisse Thybulle is going to be an old defensive level defender in the NBA. I mean, something people often will say is like, oh, this guy, his floor is Tony Allen because he's got such great defensive potential.
Well, because like, people don't actually think Tony Allen is very good. Like, you could just throw Tony Allen out and be like, that's like, people don't really recognize what it means to be an elite defensive player, I guess is what I'm saying.
And it's like, no, that's not his floor. Because
his floor is the best defensive player in the league.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways that you could be worse than that. I mean, Thybulle does come out slightly better than that in my projections. So
slightly better than Tony Allen?
Yes. I mean, I'm sure he does. He's got like basically the best defensive projection of any perimeter player ever in my system.
I mean, your projections really care about blocks and steals, right?
Yeah, which he does great.
Famously quite good at those two things.
I've heard that he is.
The other thing about your projections is, so we want to basically, a little bit of what we're doing is sort of like averaging it out because this is a zone defense, right? And he obviously won't be playing a zone in the NBA unless it's the NBA Finals. but your projections also would include numerous Syracuse players, none of whom have ever reached these heights.
They haven't, but also if you look at, and I wrote about this a few weeks ago, I did a piece on like players who had kind of the most interesting statistical projections, and Matisse was on that list. If you look at Syracuse players, the vast majority of them underperform their projections.
Really?
Yeah, and specifically the vast majority of them underperform their projected steal rate in the NBA.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, I mean, again, now there's room for Matisse Thybulle, as I pointed out.
He was a good defender before playing.
Right, and if you apply that, the extent to which Syracuse players underperform their projections in the NBA to Matisse Thybulle's projected steal rate, he still would have the best in the draft. But he's maybe just not as far off the charts as it might look statistically.
I also, it's funny because as a Husky fan, this is the thing that I was saying about Pete. It's like, we can talk bad about Pete, but other people can't. Hearing that Matisse brings nothing offensively, I'm like, well, I don't know about that.
I mean, from
watching him as a Husky fan, I'm like, why aren't you good at offense, Matisse? How did you miss that shot? But if anybody else says it, I'm like, he can knock down a corner three. Are you kidding me?
I mean, I think there's a pretty good chance that he does become a better shooter in the NBA.
Oh, he'll definitely become a better shooter.
His free throw shooting suggests some untapped potential as a three-point shooter.
He will become a better offensive player. Well, he'll become a better shooter than he is. Like, if people talk about 3-and-D players a lot, and I think that they project players to become, quote, 3-and-D, quote-unquote, 3-and-D players, when I don't know if they actually will. Matisse Thybulle is a 3-and-D player.
Yeah.
So did they have Jalen in that mock? Do you know about this thing called Control F?
No Jalen Noah.
Ah, all right.
So,
is he on the Draft Express?
The latest ESPN, Jonathan Givony. No, he is not.
He's It's going to be teammates with Kevin Durant in New York next year as an undrafted free agent.
I mean, they already have Alonzo Trier. They've been on...
Somehow he's just going to replace Alonzo Trier.
I guess it's possible they may have to decline Alonzo Trier's team option to create enough cap space. Should we talk about UW softball? So the Huskies graduate four players from this year's team, but just two starters. Tara Novello, whose last pitch was in that game.
Tara Novello, I have to say, hell of a women's college World Series.
Yeah, it was awesome. Like, her entire second half of the season after is got discussed many times during the Women's College World Series broadcast, getting shellacked by UCLA midseason. After that, I mean, she really put it together for the second half of her senior year, and a good note to go out on, even if, you know, obviously she hoped it went a little bit further.
I mean, that like I mentioned earlier, the start that she had on Saturday night against Oklahoma City, sort of in their home, against Sam Schau, a notable starting pitcher, shut them down.
Because Oklahoma State, not Oklahoma City. Yeah, I mean, that was probably the best day of her career, I would think. Because she got the save in the first game and then the win in, you know, both in elimination games. That's a pretty awesome pair of performances. The other senior starter for the Huskies was center fielder Amira Molloy, who had a solid Women's College World Series, really solid season.
Still like season. A number 7 or 8 hitter.
Number 9 hitter. I mean, she kind of acted as second leadoff hitter for the Huskies this year.
I think seeing Lori Molloy at the games is awesome.
And unfortunately, her sister is a college softball player, but is not going to UW. She's going to Tennessee. I don't know if we were recruiting her or not.
Wow.
Yeah.
She's the Luke Heward of the family, huh?
I don't know. Again, I don't know if UW recruited her or not. There's not that much college softball recruiting information out there.
Really makes you think.
You might be surprised. Okay, so for replacing Molloy, there was only a couple games she didn't start this year. First baseman Kaya Gibson and left fielder Sammy Reynolds both started at center field.
Oh, really?
So
the natural first base to center field transition.
Softball's a little different than baseball. So there's some flexibility when they did that.
Is the guy, the Mariners first baseman. Oh my God, that super slow dude.
What Daniel is Vogelbach.
That? Yeah, Vogel. Can you imagine him in center field? He looked like Jeff Nelson. They'd be better off having the righty play center fielder while the lefty faces a batter.
Yeah, that's probably true. When Gibson played out there, they put Morgan Flores at first base.
Oh, really?
And Emma Helm, who was designated player most of the year at catcher, where she played last year when Flores was injured. So that's one possible. Well, you know, I'm sure they'll sort through a few different things. They've got some backup outfielders.
Do we know incoming freshmen or anything?
I did not look that much.
I mean, the team in general is quite young.
Yeah, I mean, they had a bunch of three freshmen starting, I think 8 on the roster. So, yeah, I mean, most of the improvement is going to come from within. So the pitching staff is obviously the big question with Alvelo's departure. You can see teams that basically just use one pitcher the entire time.
They haven't settled. It's just Gabby playing.
I mean, I think ideally you would like to have a second pitcher for situations like we saw on Saturday where, you know, Alvelo can come in relief and Plain didn't have to start both games of that doubleheader. So that's nice to have. So their number 3 pitcher this year, their only other pitcher this year, was sophomore lefty Pat Moore.
She had a solid 2.5 innings.
Who transferred. No, she started some games. She started 6 games. Transferred to UW from DePaul after winning Big East Pitcher of the Year as a freshman. And then was just like barely pitching for the UW.
Wow.
That's like such a massive difference between the Big East and the Pac-12, apparently.
She clearly was recognizing that Taryn Alvelo would be graduating them.
Yeah. I mean, her explanation was she's a native of Oregon, wanted to get back home to the West Coast. So
there we go.
You know, I would expect her to step into a much larger role next year. And it, you know, kind of, it depends how well it goes. Like, if she pitches well, then it could be a situation like this year where you have much more of a rotation. If not,
2 players is a rotation.
Yes. If not, then Gabby Plain's going to throw a lot of innings. Hope she's ready.
But I mean, that's at the same time, like, you have Gabby Plain coming back. You know that you have an ace starter.
Yes.
plus players like Sis Bates, Morgan Flores, like the heart of the order coming back. This is a team that if they're not back in the Final Four again next year, you'd be surprised.
I would agree with that, yeah.
I mean, they'll go into next season, I mean, understanding that the UCLA pitcher...
Rachel Garcia.
I couldn't remember her first name. Rachel Garcia is going to be back, so UCLA is going to be awesome.
Yep.
With that, you know that UW at the very least probably will be expected to be second best in the Pac-12, which is more or less second best in the country.
Yeah.
At least top three or four.
They'll be right there in the mix.
So this is something, I mean, it's impressive what they have set up with so few upperclassmen and so few seniors.
Yeah, I mean, next year I think is going to be much more of a crucial year because I think Sis Bates will be a senior.
Yes.
Along with Flores. I mean, Plain will only be a junior, but you're going to lose a lot of your field play.
But they were playing a lot of freshmen this year.
They were.
Getting the power. So that's the thing is,
yeah,
with players who, when they got these players in scoring position, it really felt like certain parts of the lineup, like the top of the lineup, were able to get on base. And then it was just like you get to the six hitter or whatever past Sammy.
But
Reynolds.
I think the bottom half of the order got on base too. It was just again
they couldn't
once the hitters consistently runners won base.
But also understanding that Morgan Flores is basically the only power in the lineup.
Yeah,
and they have to find a way to find consistent hitting throughout the order and to find power throughout the order.
I mean, hopefully Sammy Reynolds will develop her power next season. She had a home run in Oklahoma City. That was nice. So. Yeah.
There'll be more, though. I mean, seeing like Silent Rain Espinosa being a freshman. Who are the other freshmen on the roster?
The other freshman who started... no, I can't remember off the top of my head.
All right.
It was the right fielder. Husky.
Oh, Madison Husky?
Yes.
Yeah. Both of those players, they were the 7 and 8 hitters or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, you would assume that they're going to continue to develop and being... I mean... At like 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
Like growing older, you should develop more power. It would be nice to see them have a little bit more power throughout the lineup.
For sure. I mean, that's how a large percentage of the runs are scored when you get, when you come against quality pitching like you see in the Women's College World Series.
But if we're being honest here, this is the second best team in the country.
I mean, we didn't see them against Oklahoma, but based on the way that both of those teams played UCLA, then yes.
By the transitive property.
Oh, the transitive property always works over small samples.
The sample of 3 games.
I really still don't understand how UCLA didn't win the Pac-12 outright in the regular season. They split
they
it with UW.
They shared the title. But UW's good. But they tied for 10 innings.
No, no. But they swept UW. So they lost 4 games to teams that weren't UW in Pac-12 play.
It's baseball. It's still random. The Mariners beat the Astros.
It's actually not baseball. It's softball.
I'm just saying, like, the sport is a random sport. The ball goes where it goes.
College softball is not a very random sport.
Okay, college softball. The disparity.
They didn't do as well against Arizona as UW did against Arizona. That's essentially what happened. There was a rock, paper, scissors in the Pac-12. But I'm still saying that's surprising given how good UCLA was because they won the national championship easily.
The Mariners beat the Astros tonight, like, 15-1.
Okay.
Sometimes it happens.
You don't have any hot takes on that?
No. They drafted like 9 pitchers and like 2 position players. Do you know about that?
I am aware of that. They traded Jay Bruce. I know that too.
That's your Mariners hot takes.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks. I mean, it's tough to tell the scale without a radio tall one.
How big any item is.
Yeah, I mean, could be any size. Who knows?
Grand McExtreme Bacon Burger. This is the one from Spain?
Yes.
Okay. And then the cheesy bacon fries.